Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Wayne Kestenbaum is a writer, poet, and cultural critic. Over the last few decades, he's written about culture as he sees it, from Andy Warhol to opera, from Susan Sontag to Debbie Harry. New York Magazine once called him the philosopher of fabulousness. His latest collection of personal and critical stories is called My 1980s and Other Essays. He joins me in the studio to talk about it and to share a playlist with us. Wayne Kestenbaum, welcome to Soundcheck.
I feel welcome. Thank you.
So, My 1980s, that's a pivotal decade for a lot of people. What is it about the 80s for you?
Well, it's the decade that I stopped listening to pop music, I confess. After Blondie's Call Me, I retired that part of my life. So it's the decade when I discovered opera. It's the decade of AIDS. Sad to say, but true. It's the decade of Reagan. For four of those years, I lived in New York City, and I feel like I saw it all. But as I say in my essay, I didn't go to one Andy Warhol opening. Yeah. A fact I regret.
Now, normally, you know, we think of the teenage years as kind of the formative years. That's where your musical tastes are formed, and even if your literature tastes are not completely formed, you're set down certain types of path. For you, it seems like the 80s, when you were, in your 20s, that seems to have been that formative period for you.
Well, musically, the 70s, when I was a teen, were also formative for immersion in classical music. So I would say that my musical tastes were hardwired with Bach, Brahms, Beethoven, Schumann. In that era. But I think I grew up in San Jose, California, which is a bit of a backwater, or was then. And living on the East Coast and living in New York City exposed me to hotter cultural currents.
So then not quite as hot-wired as you thought, because you were able to expand into other types of music as you grew. And,
and I continue to expand.
Mm-hmm. Now, Debbie Harry of Blondie appears on the cover of the book, the famous Andy Warhol Polaroid photograph of her, and appears in your essay, Debbie Harry at the Supermarket.
Indeed.
She is clearly more than just a voice for you. You write about her face, about the way that she moves, the way that she walks down the street. You guys live near each other, right?
Well, I'm proud to say we live in the same building, but it's a big building.
Uh-huh.
And I see her maybe once a year on the street, and those are ceremonial anointing occasions for me. Seriously.
Now, you mentioned that when Blondie recorded Call Me for that film,
American Gigolo,
that was kind of the end of your pop music phase. Mm-hmm. While you were in that pop music phase, Blondie's music seems to have been kind of pivotal for you.
It was beyond pivotal. It was, I think maybe Debbie Harry was my last heterosexual crush, and maybe the culmination of my heterosexuality. I remember even buying, I think, an interview with her in Penthouse, buying Penthouse magazine for the interview with her. It was her face. I mean, it's as I say in my essay, I'm really into big faces and small noses.
And wide-spaced
eyes. But it is also her voice and her irony.
Yeah. As in this song, The Tide Is High, you focus specifically on the line where she says,
I'm not the kind of girl who gives up just like that.
Listen to this. This is a classic from Blondie circa 1980.
It's the way you do the things you do to me.
Tide Is High from Blondie, featuring vocals by Deborah Harry. Wayne Kestenbaum writes about Debbie Harry in one of the essays in his new book, My 1980s and Other Essays, and has visited us with a playlist, which we're hearing some of. You can see his full playlist on our website at soundcheck.org. Tide Is High was Blondie's sort of attempt at doing reggae.
Mm-hmm.
But there's always that kind of cool distance, you know, whether she's doing rap in Rapture or reggae with Tide Is High, you know, there's something there.
She's standing outside the plate glass window of the very performance she's giving, and she smiles at us. She has just enough of a really great voice to stretch it and give moments of torchiness when she needs it.
Now, another line that you kind of fixate on, if I can use that word, is, I didn't have the nerve to say no, from Plastic Letters in 1978, which is a great record.
It is perfect.
And so what is it about not just the song, but this line and you know, the word no?
It's that she splits the word no, no-oh. And even though I know the song is written that way, she has to split it. I feel in each case that she's splitting it as a kind of act of her own cultural imperialism. She's deciding that word needs to be split in two to insert uncanny twinship in it. It gets to me.
You know, kids here in the East sort of grew up saying, nuh-uh. You know?
It's languorous. It's a little kind of tropical.
All right.
Here's decision.
More from Blondie from Wayne Kestenbaum's playlist for us on Soundcheck.
You got ants in your pants.
Blondie, I didn't have the nerve to say no, from their 1978 album Plastic Letters. Wayne Kestenbaum writes about Blondie and about that song in his book My 1980s and Other Essays. Is Plastic Letters your favorite Blondie record?
Yes, I'll just say it's my favorite. And even though I've heard this song hundreds of times, each time it's brand new.
Yeah.
I feel like a virgin hearing it.
I'm sort of partial to Parallel Lines myself, but Plastic Letters is a really good record.
Parallel Lines was when they were crossing over the River of No Return.
Okay.
I think the Plastic, I like it because it's less produced and I hear actually the grain of her voice. She seems more in the room.
Well, now this gets to the whole idea of you as a cultural critic, which I've always taken that term to mean somebody who can write about whatever the hell he or she wants to write about. But, you know, do you have to maintain some kind of critical objectivity, or is, as you write in another essay, is art always an emotional experience? Can you not separate your personal feelings from the act of writing about art?
I mean, I have gobs of objectivity. I inject impressionism so much into it because I don't think really people want to hear my objectivity. And the reason I also, I think, shelve my objectivity is that it's so subjective. Mm. And it's much better to, so the stuff I'm telling you I think is gospel truth, but I sell it as just Wayne's opinion.
So we're spending some time in Wayne's world when you read the book My 1980s and Other Essays. You'll be doing a couple of readings, Thursday the 22nd at Greenlight Bookstore in Fort Greene, and then Tuesday the 27th at the McNally Jackson Books in Soho. But you're also doing this thing this coming Tuesday at Light Industry in Greenpoint. What is that? It's not a reading,
right? No, it's not. It's billed as an evening with Wayne Kestenbaum, but it's actually, I'm going to show a series of screen tests, including Warhol's two Warhol screen tests of Susan Sontag, Judy Garland's wardrobe test for Valley of the Dolls, and a few other kind of art film things, to talk about what it means to be screen tested. And I'm going to read bits from my book as well. The screen test is an important concept to me.
Okay. And for folks who have not seen Andy Warhol's screen tests, do you have a cultural critic appreciation to give us?
Yeah. A quickie would be anyone who came into his studio during the Golden Age would be sat down in front of a camera for 4 minutes and told not to budge and just stare unsmiling at the camera. And these are sort of conceptual works of art, and they're also just riveting portraits.
And he got some pretty famous people. I mean, Lou Reed and...
Yes, and Susan Sontag, mm-hmm. among others. Just now, everybody.
So Susan Sontag is a kind of a cultural touchstone for you. I mean, she's, you know, a consumer of culture from all across the spectrum, and it seems like that was kind of a touchstone for you as well.
Yes, she said in one essay that it was the aesthete's prerogative to move on. And I always feel that she was moving on from discipline to discipline and passion to passion, and that's what I want to do.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned moving on from pop music in the 1980s and getting into other forms of music. Opera is something else that you write about.
It's my big one.
Frequently. There's a whole essay on Anna Moffo's Funeral, the great soprano, whose face you also write about.
Can't help it, yes.
Comparing her to a sugar cookie.
Oh, yes. I don't know if she'd like that, but I mean well.
Now, you have written in the past about gay men's affinity for opera in The Queen's Throat, Opera, Homosexuality, and the Mystery of Desire. What is, I mean, how do you make that case without just falling into, you know, stereotype and conventional tropes and things like that?
Well, I mean, my theory of stereotype is you fall into it and it gives way into profundity. So I pass through the valley of the stereotype. So yes, it is a stereotype that some gay men have always loved opera. And I think it's gay men have been custodians of a certain kind of culture. They're the archivists and accountants and... I don't know, witnesses to certain kinds of cultural greatness. And it's like a shaman's identity, and I take it very seriously.
So Anna Moffo, for you...
the very best.
Yeah. She stopped performing, though...
Pretty early.
Probably when you were just a teenager, right?
Mm-hmm.
Did you ever get to see her?
I heard her in the twilight years of her career... once at Melody Tent in Baltimore. I think I write about that in this book. And she was mic'd, I remember, which is sort of a thing opera singers aren't supposed to do. So that there was that one encounter. But to me, it's an entirely a love affair via the LP.
And one that we're going to hear is Anna Moffo not singing opera, but singing some songs by Debussy.
Yes.
This is a rarity.
It's a rarity. It was recorded in the early 70s. It's one of her last great recordings, and it is so sultry.
It's five poems of Baudelaire, and this is the fifth of them, L'amour des amants. Anna Moffo, not on the opera stage, but the more intimate song repertoire, the leader or chanson, L'amour des amants from the five poems of Baudelaire, recorded by Anna Moffo back in 1972. That's part of Wayne Kestenbaum's playlist for us on Soundcheck today. Visit soundcheck.org to see his full playlist. The book is called My 1980s and Other Essays. There is an essay about Anamuffo's
funeral.
And if I could
just say that what's so exciting about that is, as opposed to being on the opera stage, is that her voice is so voluptuous that hearing it just with the piano is twice as exciting.
Yeah. And, you know, when you get to a future voice on your playlist, Leontine Price, I had the experience of sitting on stage at an event at Carnegie Hall and Leontine Price making a kind of surprise appearance. It was a press thing, but she came out and she sang for us. And you know the episode of Seinfeld where George talks about being draped in velvet? That's what it felt like. To be in the presence of a voice like that without a big thunderous orchestra behind her, just a piano. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's extraordinary.
I heard her sing live at the Met in 1985 in just a recital, and I write in my essay, My 1980s, I still remember the sensation of her voice in my body.
Yeah, which is why I guess, you know, opera purists are so averse to amplification. I mean, you mentioned
right.
seeing Anamuffo with a microphone. Which would have been disappointed, but that kind of laser focus
mm-hmm.
that...
It ambushes you from within. It enters your blood cells, the voice.
Do you get to the opera a lot?
Not as much as I'd like, but I do go.
And do you sit in the orchestra, the fancy
seats?
Can't
afford that. No. I sit up high. I like sitting in the balcony, which is also not cheap, but the balcony, I think, is the absolute best.
But they say that the cheap seats, that's where the voice really blooms at a place
and
like
that. That's where I sat in the 1980s to hear the greats in the second to last row. That's where I heard Leonie Riesenek.
Mm. So the idea that the best seats give you the best sound, not necessarily true in a good opera house.
Very true.
Yeah. All right. So Leontine Price, tell me a little bit about this recording of songs that she did.
Well, this is from 1959, which is at the very beginning of her career. And what's so uncharacteristic about this, in a way, it's a Poulenc song. Though she was famous for her performance in San Francisco in Dialogues of the Carmelites, but still, it's not a repertoire she's firmly associated with. And just, I chose this because the philosophy of Les Sikhs, which is a group of composers, Sati, etc., their attitude of incorporating playfulness and lightness and irony into classical music is a principle that has influenced my literary production a lot.
Yeah. That group of composers you refer to, Les Sikhs, probably worth mentioning, at least one of those was a woman. So they were pretty progressive, you know, at
very
a time when
so.
Composers were very much a boys' club. One of those six of Les Six was Francis Poulenc. Here's one of his songs sung by Leontine Price. Recording of Leontine Price, great American soprano, song by Francis Poulenc called Tu vois le feu du soir, recorded in 1959. It's clearly Leontine Price, but clearly
but
younger.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But all the richness intact.
Yeah. Wayne Kestenbaum writes about Leontine Price and Anamuffo and Deborah Harry and lots more in his new collection, My 1980s and Other Essays. And we'll be reading next Thursday at Greenlight Bookstore in Fort Greene, the Tuesday after that, August 27th, at McNally Jackson Books in Soho. This coming Tuesday is the screen test thing that we were talking about before at Light Industry in Greenpoint. And you can see Wayne's full playlist on our website at soundcheck.org. It includes a healthy dose of contemporary classical music. You will allude at one point to writing on your old IBM Selectric or whatever it is, to the music of Luciano Berio at
Indeed.
One point.
Yes, and I've written to Boulez. I write to Feldman and Nono all the time. If we could have fit Nono's opera in, I would have put him in. That stuff is very important to me.
Yeah.
Cage.
And do you, I mean, Morton Feldman, a lot of his pieces are about extended time, you know, the string quartet that takes literally 5 hours to play and stuff. Does that kind of sense of time, is that one of the things that draws you to contemporary music?
It is, but it's also brevity. What draws me most to contemporary music are, your immortal words, new sounds. Sounds I have never heard that are intrinsically titillating because of their newness. And also, I think, timbres and adventures in silence. Mm-hmm. I like the composers who allow for maximum intermission.
So John Cage, Morton Feldman, people like that. Wayne, you have an essay called Advice to the Young and a very entertaining series of videos online about humiliation. I was going to say avoiding humiliation, but in fact, the idea seems to be don't avoid humiliation. No. Own your humiliation.
Own it. Plunge into it. Accept it. Don't cause it. Don't try to get more humiliated, but pass through its fire
and
transmute it into something glorious. Turn it into a badge of honor, the way Oscar Wilde did.
You've written about humiliation in the past. Are you an expert on this particular facet of the human experience?
I think I've become an expert. It's a sad identity, perhaps. But I feel, I could say, since publishing that book, I have felt less humiliated than before publishing it.
All right. Well, Wayne, it's been a great experience having you here with us on Soundcheck today. Thanks for sharing some of your playlist with us.
My pleasure.
The full playlist is on our website at soundcheck.org. This is on it as well. Jesse Norman singing a song by Robert Schumann. Oh,